Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Merry Christmas. Hope everyone's doing well, as we are only a few days away from the big event. We are going to work through chapter 21 and go well into chapter 22 today of the book of Acts. And see where that takes us. It's actually seems like a significant amount of scripture we'll be going through, but some of it is some repetition from the past, at least some stories. You'll see what I mean here when we get there later on in chapter 22. So that'll kind of help speed up the conversation a bit. We'll take a break over Christmas and then get back going in January, but here we are in chapter 21. Starting in verse 15 today, it's going to be an exciting ride, an exciting journey for Paul, because as you can imagine, based on where he's been and the places he's been going and wants to go, it's been quite a journey, and his ultimate goal at this point is to make it to Jerusalem in time for Pentecost, and he is traveling thousands of miles to do this. He has made his way south from Caesarea, going up into Jerusalem. He was told, as you recall from last time, that he was told by many. Many had seen visions and dreams telling Paul not to go because of knowing what he would face when he made it to Jerusalem. And even Agabus makes another appearance. He made another appearance last week, his second appearance in Acts, and actually did an old school version of prophecy demonstrating what will happen to Paul when he goes into Jerusalem. Either way, no matter what they say, no matter how many tears are shed on the shorelines, he decides to go. He sets his face like a stone, much like Jesus did. When Jesus went to Jerusalem, Paul is doing the same thing here, because he truly believes that he's being led by the Holy Spirit to make his way fully into Jerusalem so that he can continue his ministry. And so that's where we start today, as Paul and his crew and a few Caesareans continue to join him. Let's read 15 through 26, and then we will have a discussion over that section of scripture, and then we will continue on from there. Please keep in mind, Paul was not well liked in Jerusalem at this point. Well, if you recall why, from his time of persecuting Messianic Jews as well as Hellenistic believers, or Hellenistic Jews who'd become believers. So they had a memory. They had memory that remembered him quite well and really did not want him back there. Fortunately, he had a few allies remaining in Jerusalem to kind of help him out, but for the most part, he was kind of the most wanted guy on the list when he made it into town. All right, so verse 15 of chapter 21. After these days, we got ready and started on our way to Jerusalem. Some of the disciples from Caesarea also came with us, taking us to Mnason of Cyprus, also known as a Cypriot, a disciple of long standing with whom we were to lodge. After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly, the brothers and sisters of Jerusalem. And the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Remember, James, this is James the Just. He's the head of the Jerusalem church at this time. Many believe he is the brother, or I guess it would be half-brother of Jesus, depending on what you believe in the virgin birth. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealots, zealous for the law. And they have been told about you, that you are teaching all of the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the custom." So we quickly get here. Yay, Paul, thanks for doing what you're doing. But by the way, there's a lot of people upset with you because of your horrible, horrible lies. At least that's what they've been told, and that's what they're afraid of. There's a little bit of anxiety here in the Jerusalem church. And we'll see a little bit more of that here in a second. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, because of this, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them, most likely a Nazarite vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses. That's very nice of them. So that they may shave their heads and all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. But concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols and from blood and from what is strangled and from fornication. Fornication is like prostitution here. It's not just they can't have sex. It's unwedded sex, sex among the cults of the pagan temples and pagan beliefs, and of course all the really bad orgies and related things that were going on there, like in Ephesus and Philippi and Rome. I mean, you name it, bad things were happening. Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went to the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. We'll talk a little bit about what those sacrifices look like, but it's believed that it's similar to the sacrifice that Paul had already done well back in this book, where he had cut his hair as a type of, many would say, a kind of a short-term Nazarite vow. Anywho, away we go. So like I said, Paul and his group are heading south from Caesarea. There's some comrades from Caesarea with them as well. And they had spent several days in Caesarea. And so they, and then after that time, I guess they would, not I guess, I know. I mean, that's at least that's what history tells us. They begin their trip. Going to Jerusalem, which, like I said, is about 64 miles south over land. Most likely, based on some of Luke's inferences here, there were animals with them, so most likely they rode part of it. If maybe they were just pack mules or just mules or horses. Hard to tell, but that seems to be something that's inferred in this, based on the original language. It's kind of hard to see in the English, but in the Greek, it seems like it's a little clearer there are animals with them. Like I said, they have some friends from Caesarea. They're in verse 16 who go on ahead and arrange a place for Paul and the rest to go upon their arrival. I don't think we can parallel this too much with what Jesus sitting in disciples ahead of him. Could be, maybe not. Read into that as you would like. There are some similarities with Paul returning to Jerusalem and Jesus going to Jerusalem. Some of them are seem to be tightly related. Others maybe just seem to be circumstantial, but yeah, either way, that's how it is. So these people go in ahead. Some of Paul's friends go in, and seems like they identify or find Mnason there, who, like I said, is a Cypriot, which pretty much means he's from Cyprus, and also seems to be maybe a pillar of the community, a big leader of the community, and it's quite a deal for the Cypriot to be doing this, as many in the Jerusalem church were still not comfortable with entertaining Gentiles in their homes. He was a Jewish man, by the way. Just because he was from Cyprus doesn't mean he wasn't Jewish. Had it probably from the diaspora, most likely, and come back to Jerusalem. And we have to remember, and as we'll see, and as the reaction happens as we read through this, the people in Jerusalem, of course, are still very Jewish. And so they have their Jewish traditions and customs. And most likely, you know, did not like the mixing, or we know for sure they did not like the mixing of Jews and Gentiles, especially when it came to eating, as in for purification reasons and stuff like that. Anyways, Mnason is Hellenistic. He's probably one of the few remaining Hellenists remaining in Jerusalem. There, for the most part, many of them, I think, would leave after Stephen was martyred several years before. Others probably hung out for a while, and eventually the Jews probably just kicked him out of the Messianic Jews or the true Jews, depending on probably a couple varieties of that, pushed them out over the years. To kind of make this a little bit easier to digest, it seems like, based on what we know, Mnason may not lived exactly in Jerusalem, but between Caesarea and Jerusalem. which would of course make the Gentile hanging out with him and other Jews a little bit more plausible and palatable. Not that that matters in the day, it's still a controversial thing that he did. So that's verses 15 and 16. So verses 17 through 26, after being amongst the Gentiles for a long period of time, Paul goes full force back into his Jewish world there in Jerusalem. And during this time, we see a huge divide that is formed between the Gentile believers and the Jewish Christians. We also see, of course, a continued chasm between the Jews who remained true to their traditional faith and those who had become believers in the Messiah. So that has grown as well. And it seems, and it is our understanding, that James the Just, who's the James that we will see here in a few verses, had, for the most part, kept the peace amongst them because he was highly regarded and highly respected by both Messianic Jews and traditional Jews. The people who received them gladly or rejoicing, and there, of course, was Mnason. That is, so if verse 17 is a continuation of verses 15 and 16, if it's not, it could be this an anticipation of what is about to be said by James, that James and his friends and his council were gladly received Paul and his crew. Now, what could make this kind of seem strange, and where I think it's tied to verses 15 and 16, is that brethren is not specific to males, but is a male and female version of that word. And so brothers and sisters of Christ received us gladly, and most likely, very likely, be very odd if it wasn't like this, that James and the elders that we see there in verse 18 were all men. So there's also some awkwardness there in verse 18. When it either, depending on your version, it could be the following day or the next day. Could be, you know, that just kind of adds some awkwardness to the text. But I like to look at it as being verses 15 and 16. And it's odd how sometimes we get stuck on stuff like that. But that's just that's part of the fun of reading a ancient text. Verse 18, it seems like all the elders of the church were present, telling us that it was quite a large home that James was residing in that time to fit all the people. And all those elders may have lived in Jerusalem or had come into Jerusalem. Most likely they were living in Jerusalem. But remember, there is a festival going on, which is why we get a lot more people typically in this. Well, I don't want to ruin the story in the riot later on. Note and recall here that Paul was bringing a gift to Jerusalem. Remember, the Gentile churches had prepared a monetary gift for the church in Jerusalem because the church in Jerusalem seemed to have some financial trouble going on, or at least it's hard to support all of its members or to be supported by its members. And this goes back to the other time that Paul was in Jerusalem, where they all were to remember the poor. And it seems like that is continuing to happen, where they are to remember those who are poor in the church. And that's where that comes through from the elders there in the church. Of all the apostles, only James remains in Jerusalem and, of course, then becomes head of the church. And we can see that earlier on in Acts, where, you know, Peter and John have gone on to expand their missionary journeys. And we have not heard of them for several chapters now, but it seems like there was that transition between Peter and James earlier on, of course, in Acts. And like I said, there's many who believe in the, you know, at least on the Protestant side, and even it had to be the Protestant side. I was thinking more evangelical, but even Protestant side believe that James the Just was the brother of Jesus, and that he was very well respected, as referred to as James the Just, and was more so in as both Messianic Jews as well as traditional Jews. The elders that are referenced here, there are probably about 70 of them, all in all, and that really kind of gives us an idea of the size of the church, which was probably pretty expansive, at least for that time period, but it continued to dwindle, because we're only about 15 to 20 years from 70 AD, when the temple will be destroyed, and a lot of the Christians and the Jews are, for the most part, kicked out and removed from Jerusalem when Rome destroys the temple. So it's, this point is still a relatively decent size gathering of people. Verses 19 through 21, Paul tells them how the Holy Spirit is moving in the Gentile world, and recalls that and helps. I guess he is able to recall that and helps to bring that to real life for James and the others by bringing these brothers from the other churches from Ephesus and from Caesarea and from the other locations that he's been. He wanted the people in Jerusalem, because it was where it all kind of started, he wanted them to see that fruit was being produced outside the walls of Jerusalem, outside the area or region of Judea, and that there were many Gentiles who had come to know who the Messianic Messiah, that's redundant, who the Messiah was. Go there for right now. James, of course, and the rest of the group are super pumped about this and by the growth of their church and of the church, yet there's also a bit of underlying anxiety that we see based on what they're about to see with the leaders in the Jerusalem church. It seems like there are some nasty rumors going around about Paul saying that he had been saying bad things or negative things or anti-Jewish things about the Jewish faith, and is not requiring Gentiles to follow Jewish beliefs. And that's true, partially true, and that's fine, and that was agreed upon, if you remember, from the Jerusalem Council from many chapters back, when James and the rest of the council said, okay, they don't have to be circumcised, the AB and Gentiles, but there are a few things we're gonna require from them, and that's the not eating of meat with blood in it, and the fornication. Yeah, and those are the two major things. Now, of course, there are a lot of Jewish zealots, much like Paul was, so we get a lot of reminiscence of who Paul used to be and how black and white he looked at the world, especially from a Jewish law perspective. And there were enough of these zealots still around, causing enough of a fuss there in Jerusalem, wanting Paul to be punished for what he had done. And so that was putting a lot of pressure on James and the rest of the elders. So James and their group seemed pretty good with what Paul was doing. They're for the most part happy. I don't think they were ever fully comfortable with the Gentile church and some of the separations that Paul was allowing between the Jews and the Gentiles. But for the most part, they seemed pretty comfortable with what Paul was doing. With that said, because of their anxiety with the zealots and the issues the zealots were causing, they needed something from Paul for him to kind of them to make them feel better about themselves. Well, not themselves, but the status of the church or the status of the Jewish faith, to help the Messianic Jews along, as well as to help the traditional Jewish believers along. And so they needed that verbal assurance from Paul. And Paul being a Pharisaic Jew, Paul knowing their laws, goes along, and you could probably even think that, okay, whatever, I know this doesn't matter, I know it isn't going to work, but I'll do it. I'll do it to appease you. And it kind of feels that's what he's doing here. But he does it from a Jewish perspective. He never comes around and says, yes, Gentiles need to do this as well. They need to go through the vows. They need to be circumcised. They need to follow any of these Jewish traditions that you guys are really pushing upon us. And he makes it clear in Galatians chapter 5 when he's writing that letter to Galatia, chapter 5, verses 2 through 4, that Gentiles do not need to be circumcised as in some sort of insurance policy against their faith in Christ. And the reason he would say that is because that would mean if they required Gentiles to be circumcised to show their faith, it for the most part says that their faith is not enough, and it ultimately says that the gospel is not enough, because that has all been removed through this. Paul believes that he even get a sense that even with Jewish people, he believes that circumcision does not make a difference whatsoever with God, with how God feels about those who believe in him. You got to think about that. You have your traditional Jews, you have your Messianic Jews, you have your Gentiles, and you have your God-fearers who are Gentiles who really want to be Jews but can't be because of circumcision. But they're all people who have faith in God. And Paul understands that, but it seems like there's others who can't just seem to step outside of that box. And the other side is that Paul would even say, I would think that if there were Messianic Jews and they still want to follow Jewish traditions, follow Jewish traditions, that's fine. If you want your children circumcised, have them circumcised. That's fine too. It's up to them, but it's not a requirement. He had the same sort of level of flexibility when it came to foods and certain foods people could eat and who could mingle and intermingle and with each other. So, as a Jew, he had no issue conforming to Jewish customs when he was in a Jewish community. He did not see a need to have to enforce those customs. If you're a Jew in a Jewish community and you want to do Jewish things, do it. If you're a Jew in a Jewish community and you don't want to do Jewish things anymore, don't do it. It's about faith in God. So you can imagine how tricky it was for Paul, and especially for some of our Messianic Jews and those who thought like Paul, to be in an intermixed setting of Jews and Gentiles, especially early on. But it seems that he is able to, for the most part, navigate this situation by providing as little offense as possible to those around. So he said some pretty bold and courageous things, and we knew him to be that way, but at the same time, he knew how to navigate some of the emotions and traditions of that time. Man, it feels like we're crawling along here, but it speeds up, trust me. Anyway, verses 22 and through 24, based on Paul's flexibility, the council of the elders ask Paul to do something to take the heat off of them from the zealots, those who are zealous, and if he could do something that would prove to them that he is a practicing and observant Jew. They were, as you see here, they were still so stuck on the past traditions, they could not see the work that God was doing throughout the world. They were so stuck and focused on kind of, you know, their belly button gazing or navel gazing, that they were, they couldn't see the bigger picture. You could also use the forest for the trees analogy, or the trees for the forest. They're so focused on a tree, they couldn't see the forest. And there's many different ways you could look at it, but that was what was happening. The world was changing around them, and they were so reluctant to change to see the work that God was doing, thinking that they were doing God's work, but at the end of the day, they really weren't. They'd kind of got stuck. Unfortunately, we continue to do that today. We get stuck in our traditions and our doctrines and everything. We lose sight of what God is doing around us because we become rigid, and mainly that's based out of fear and worried of loss of power. So that's part of that as well. Verse 23, we're introduced to four men. We're not exactly who they are, where they came from, what they do. It is believed, I would assume, that they're Jewish men, and maybe they had done something along the way to defile themselves. And so they are here to take a Nazaritic vow, or a vow of a Nazarite, and there were short-term versions of that. It wasn't just how Samson lived. And they're asking Paul to join in and participate and pay. And this is actually a 30-day vow, which for the most part was standard for a vow like this. During this time, they'd act like Nazarites. They would abstain from wine and strong drink and something to do with grape skins. They wouldn't devour grape skins, something to do with the tannins or something. I don't know. It was something to do so they would not defile themselves. They would not hang out with the corpse. They would, as in, because if they touched a corpse or was around someone who's dead, they'd be, of course, impure. They would not cut their hair. That was just a symbol, I guess, probably an outward symbol of what they were doing based on what their vow. At the end of this 30-day period, I'm not sure it depends on how fast your hair grows, but 30 days after shaving your head, your hair's probably not that long. But anyways, it's long enough to what they would do is they would shave off... that's all right. So that they would keep their hair. So at the beginning of the vow, they would keep their hair and wait till the end of the 30-day period, and at that point, offer that hair as a sacrifice. referred to as the hair of consecration, and this hair would be burned along with a male and a female lamb, as well as with a drink offering and a food offering would be given as part of this consecration and ritual for purification. In order to do this, Paul would need to purify himself after spending so much time with the Gentiles, because obviously you spend time around Gentiles, you're impure at that point. So we are working through this. Like I said, Luke doesn't tell us why the four men needed to be purified, but of course they had been defiled. And hey, what a convenient time is now. Hey, these four guys are about to jump into this process. Paul, why don't you do the same thing? We can kill five birds now with one stone, and it'll be awesome, and everyone will be purified, and the zealots will be happy, and we can all go beyond and among and throughout our day. But then they say something else, which is interesting. They make a clarification on the Gentiles. So Paul, you do all this, and I know we work with the Gentiles, and Gentiles do their thing, and da 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 da. But Paul, you're still going to have to act like a Jew and do Jewish things. But then they make it clear and a reminder of what they did tell the Gentiles several chapters back, related to the apostolic decree, not creed, but decree that they gave to the Gentiles churches, where, again, this is where the people would have to remember to abstain from eating flesh sacrificed to idols or killed in such a way where the blood was not fully drained, and, of course, the practice of fornication. Paul, of course, is not hearing this for the first time, and he was very aware of the decree and knew how it worked. But the context here allows for the repetition for those who are reading along and who, for the first time, be hearing this, either Luke telling the story or reading the story from the scrolls in which Luke was writing from. The other focus here is on on the teachings that Paul has given the Jewish believers. They were wanting to assure the zealots that Paul's not telling them to abandon their ancestral customs. You have to think that that Jerusalem is under Roman law. They're under Roman guard. They're only able to not be blown up by the Romans because the Romans have agreed well back that they can worship their God and they can pray for Caesar, but they cannot cause riots or cause problems, and they must stay peaceful. And if they don't stay peaceful, the hammer comes down. And so they're under this oppressive regime, even though it kind of seemed like it was an oppressive regime, as long as they stayed in line. And now they have this other guy, Paul, who used to be one of them, and he's now not one of them, at least, well, he'll actually try to say he is. He'll go through this purification process. And he may have grown up as a Pharisee, but he's not one of them anymore. And now he's telling all these other Jews around the world that they no longer have to be Jews. And that's how they are hearing it. And that's not Paul's teaching, but that's what they're hearing. And that, again, that as time has gone on over history and to this day, people hear what they want to hear. People hear and read what they already believe, and that satisfies them. And they don't want to hear differing views and different ideas. And that's just unfortunate. Not all people, but many people are like that. It seems like there is a mob mentality related to that. Our social media channels have made that even worse, because we dare not read something else that someone else we disagree with would say, because God forbid we actually see a different perspective. And that's what's happening here. And it's even happening with James and the just and the others. They did not see it, but Paul does, and it's going to get Paul into a lot of trouble. So verse 26, Paul does as he says he's going to do with the four other men. They start the purification process. It takes about 7 days for the first part of the process to happen. I could not imagine. Oh my gosh, gee whiz. I guess if you're used to it as part of your culture to do it, but man, that just seems tedious. It seems like, though Paul doesn't really fully on board with this, as in, hey, this is great, let's just go through the motions, he wants to help out. He's still wanting to help out his Jewish brothers, but at the same time, what he says in 1 Corinthians 9:20, He says, to those under the law, I became one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. As in, okay, I'll play your game. I'll act like this is all good. But at the same time, I'm not under your same rules as I used to be, because now it is Jesus who's in charge and not you. Very interesting paraphrase, but that's kind of how that could work. And the elders here, of course, were well-meaning as well, but at the same time, they were in a pinch. They didn't want to use their power. They didn't want the Romans to intervene. They wanted the riots to stay to a minimum, the people to be happy as they could be, but yet they're very worried and anxious about what the zealots would think. Some would say that the money was being held in the balance, as in the Jerusalem church would not accept the money that Paul had brought from these Gentile churches unless it was consecrated through, I guess, the purification of Paul. If this is so, Luke makes no indication of it, but, you know, PhD theologians and researchers and historians like to kind of interject their thoughts into things. Even if history is not interesting enough, we like to make it kind of our own version of history. All right. Well, that took way much longer than it should have. But anyways, we will continue through verse 27 now through 36. Yes, 36. And as we'll notice here, as I read through this and as we continue on and then eventually into chapter 22, things go sideways for Paul very quickly. As the Asian Jews, also known as the Jews from Ephesus, take a stand against Paul in the temple, they show up, and it's not only them, but everyone else is just kind of ticked at Paul right now, the zealots, the Asian Jews, random people who don't know him, random people who do know him. That's another way to think about it. There are people in the crowd that Paul grew up with, you'd assume, right? He's in Jerusalem. He grew up in that area. He went to school there. He's was there for years, and it's like a really bad homecoming. But there's all different types of people that we'll be meeting through this that we can assume were there. People, you know, when they saw that Paul got an A in ancient Aramaic, oh, they were upset. And so they're finally Paul, the studious guy, is getting his just desserts. There could be that people to the people who have no idea who this Paul is and could care less, and it just looks like a good fun time because people are yelling. Anyways, when the 7 days, verse 27, when the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him. So the Asian, like I said, the Jews from Asia is the Jews from Ephesus, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law in this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place." We don't know. I think it's a rumor, but that he did that. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was provoked, and the people rushed together. Taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut. There's a lot of stuff with that part. While they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. It's fun how that works, right? It's like the media today. Everyone hates everyone. All of Rome was in confusion. No, well, there's a piece of Rome. Or Jerusalem that was in confusion, but there are probably plenty of people still at the shop doing shopping stuff. But anyways, and then people still getting along. At once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. That's a significant amount of people, it sounds like. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains and began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another. I haven't heard anyone ever do this before in Jerusalem. And when he could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob, for the multitude of people kept following them, shouting, "Away with him!" Wow. Wow. God, does that sound familiar? Maybe the Jesus story. Let's see here. 33. I'm going to look at some different ways. Commanding officer. I don't know if that's... It should be tribune. Oh, they're using Chili Arc, which would be Centurion, 100 men, Tribune. Anyways, here or there, there's different, depending on your translation, we'll kind of give that guy a different name or a different title. Verses 27 through 29, we've met the end of the purification process. We're at the last, 7 days of it, and wrapping that up. And all things go haywire at this point. He's there in the temple, doing his temple duties, I guess signing off on the paperwork that he's done the purification process. So besides the Jews of the dispersion, those from Asia did not really like Paul as well. He had really caused them to dislike them when he was in Ephesus. You remember he argued with them in the synagogues in Ephesus. They found out that he was here. They probably didn't come to Jerusalem specifically because Paul was, but probably were there for Pentecost and to travel there and found out Paul was there. And that's when you have these issues. Most likely all these out-of-town Jews were there for, like I said, Pentecost, and this would be a good time for all of them who had some sort of pent-up hatred towards Paul to come after him, and now they were all together in one place. The poor man, Trophimus, I can never say his name right if I'm not looking at it. Trophimus, sorry. Was a Gentile, and Gentiles were certainly not allowed in the temple. The people assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple during the final stages of the purification process. It was actually considered a capital offense for Gentiles to be inside certain parts of the temple. There were the outer courts referred to as the court of the Gentiles, but once they got past that, big problems would happen. They could be killed immediately. It wouldn't really take any sort of tribune or courts or anything like that to do that. And the thing is, the Roman authorities were on board with this and would allow the Jewish leaders put trespassers to death without a trial, even if they were Roman citizens, which, as we learn with Paul here, and unfortunately that he is a Roman citizen here as we get closer and closer to the end of this book, the Romans were very reluctant, and most of the time, based on what we've seen with their track record here, would not kill a Roman citizen unless there was a fair trial. And that's kind of how that all worked out. So just a little bit more story here. They would actually post signs in Latin and Greek on the doors and walkways into outside of the outer courts. And it would say, I believe if I remember right, "No foreigner may enter within the barricade which surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone who is caught trespassing will bear personal responsibility for his ensuing death." I assume that's her ensuing death too, but hey, why not? You could write "for their ensuing death." That'd probably have been the more appropriate way to say it. Am I right? But anyways, evidence of these signs were found around 1871 and then again in 1935. And so historical evidence that there were signs that said this. Paul would be very aware of this law, as would all the Jews in Jerusalem be very aware of it. And their thought is that he was not only told Jews to no longer be Jews, but he's also brought a Gentile into the temple. This man must be stopped, this heretic, this man who is destroying the Jewish tradition and Jewish faith must now go away forever and ever and be killed because he is ruining everything Jewish and all that is good. A very similar charge that is brought to Stephen back earlier on in Acts, before, of course, Stephen was stoned. Verse 30, in the city, there is the riot of all riots break out as Paul seized in the court of Israel and dragged out to the outer court there of the temple. Many in the city hear about this and seem to have nothing better to do, so they head over there. They're probably still people just keeping about their day who could really care less what's going on, but you always have your looky-loos and gossips and everyone else who wants to be part of it. The gates to the inner sanctuary was closed by the most likely the temple police in order to preserve the sanctity of the sacred inner precincts of the temple, as it could not witness the inside of the temple could not witness any sort of violence or death, and especially if Paul was about to die, which it seemed they would be allowed to do based on what he just did. we don't hear what happens to his friend. It's like he is dragged out along with his friend. It seems like it's just it just seems like Paul's dragged out. I don't see any evidence, and Luke doesn't say anything that they were both beat up, and so that other guy, he just kind of disappears, or he was never there, which is probably more likely the story. He may have been with Paul in the city, but never there in the temple. And I just don't see Paul wanting to do that. He's not someone to provoke in that way. Now, he'd provoke in debate and in discussions to a point, but he wouldn't provoke as in doing something passive-aggressive like this. He's not me. Anyways, there's some intended symbolism that we think we're seeing here with what Luke is trying to do about the doors being immediately shut. Paul and the Word of God are removed from the temple because Paul, of course, being the one who's to take all the word of God to the Gentiles, and he is the one who is carrying the word to the Gentiles. So that's part of the fun of what he'll be doing. And so once they're removed, the temple, according to what Luke may be saying here, is no longer able to fill its role. The exclusion of God's message or the word of God and the messenger who was taking out the word of God had been sealed out of the temple and thus had sealed the fate, pointing to the ultimate destruction of the temple that Jesus references if you go back to Luke 21:6, which we know historically happened in 70 AD. Actually, it's supposed to be AD 70, which sounds like AD 70 when, from people like me, but AD 70. You're supposed to say, so it's maybe 70 BC or AD 70. It's interesting how that works, but that's how they do it. All right, 31 through 36. We have mass hysteria there around the temple courts, or around the temple. The Jews, once again, are going after Paul, running him out of town, trying to beat him up. It's happened multiple times before. It wasn't just some Gentiles in Ephesus who wanted to beat Paul up. There were plenty of Jews who wanted to beat Paul up as well. Again, Paul is saved by the Jews, by the Gentiles, this time by a military tribune. Some would say a commander. I have here a chiliarch, depending on what you're looking for. Anyways, the tribune here was most likely a younger up-and-comer, someone of high societal status, or someone working their way up in society, someone of means, someone they believed was a high performer who would do well for the Romans as he got older, and so would be put in charge of a group such as this. In verses 31 and 32, Paul was quickly getting torn up with the beating he was receiving from the crowd, but fortunately, with the intervention of the Roman garrison, they seemed to save his life. So the way that was built back then is that northwest of the temple, and literally connected by a couple stairways, was the Antonia Fortress. And at that point, it had a garrison of soldiers were stationed there, so about 1,000 men in all. You probably have about 760 foot soldiers, and the rest would be cavalry. And it was connected, like I said, by two flights of stairs for this very reason, that when the Jews got out of hand, they could run down there and calm them down and take out a few of them just to kind of make a point. The tribune hears of the riot, so sends down his centurions. Remember, centurions are typically one centurion is in charge of 100 men. I don't think, because a couple centurions go down, I don't think you have over... It doesn't say. It says some soldiers and centurions. There's probably some guys sitting around, playing dice and heard that there's this confusion going on, or maybe they were on duty at the time, but I don't think you had a couple hundred people heading down that way, but a decent amount to get Paul and to save him. The tribune, commander, chiliarch, depending on what you want to call him, all go down. He goes down as well and tries to rescue Paul, which they do. For the most part, rescue him by arresting him. The Jews know to be hands off at that point, even though it seems like they're pretty hot at the time and are still trying to take him out. And so the Jewish soldiers have to eventually lift him up and carry him on out of there. Ultimately, the tribune knew that whoever this man was, and no matter what this man did, in Rome, and him being a tribune and as someone who arrested him, this man would have to be... go through the legal process. it was too loud, as we see there in verses 33 and 34, for him to hear what Paul had done. So he orders the soldiers, of course, to take Paul back to the garrison to be questioned. Verses 35 and 36, the crowd was not impressed that they had taken, that this tribune, again, remember, the Jews did not like the Romans. They tolerated them because they didn't want to die. So they weren't super excited that they had Paul removed from their grasp. So they tried to get him back by pulling him away from the soldiers, it seems here in those two verses. And so the soldiers had to carry him up the stairs to keep him out of harm's way. This would be one other time Paul could reflect on about another time where he had remained humble, or had to be humbled, or was humbled because of situations just like this. The chants are reminiscent that we hear of the same chant made to Jesus about 27 years before in a very similar spot. So that's all made pretty clear through all this as well. All right, let's wrap up chapter 22, chapter 21. Where are we here? Oh, we're good. As Paul, chapter 21, verse 37 through 40, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek?" And that would be in a very much like that, because he's like, there's no way this guy knows Greek. But there's a different take on that too, but anyways. "Then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness." That is so random. Who would have thought? But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, I guess we'll find out when we start chapter 22. So anyways, 21, 37 through 40, before making it back up to into the fortress or the garrison, Paul asked to speak in Greek to the people. You'd think Paul would want to get out of there. These people are trying to kill him, but not Paul. No, no, no. Remember, he's wanted to run into many a riots in the past and many of protests. So he's one to do that. And so it's not a surprise that he's going to do that here, or wants to do that here. So though badly beaten, he takes control of the situation once again. And we learn some ignorance of the tribune, thinking that Paul was a criminal from Egypt. As it seems, 3 years earlier, someone who had caused a similar commotion from Egypt, the thought was that possibly returned and was causing some additional commotion there around the temple. We don't know exactly who this is, who this Egyptian adventurer was, but he appeared in Jerusalem at one point claiming to be a prophet and led a large group. I think it was about 4,000. Is that what you said? Yeah, 4,000 men to the Mount of Olives. And from there, they were to lay down and wait for the city walls to fall flat. And then they were to charge the Roman garrison once that happened. That did not happen. So this guy takes off and he disappears, though many of the people that followed him were killed. Felix, who was their procurator during that time of Judea, learned of this. And he is the one who, for the most part, once he heard that this Egyptian marauder or adventurer was up there in the Mount of Olives, sent his own forces there to find this guy. But this guy disappears before he's able to get there. But just for good measure, Felix has them kill some of the people who are following him along. So Paul requests here in his eloquent Greek that he is not an Egyptian, and thus the tribune allows him to speak. Now, what's interesting about this is some people would say that Egyptians were not speaking Greek back then, but there's a lot of historical evidence that Egyptians would be speaking Greek. Maybe the surprise to the tribune was that it was such well-formed Greek or educated, and this guy was not, the Egyptian guy was not well-educated. He maybe could speak a type of Greek, but was not the formal, proper Greek that Paul was speaking. And so that's part of it. And because you remember that the signage, so Greek was, Latin was not, but at that point, Greek was probably one of the most spoken languages in in Asia and in that area. Now, of course, you had Aramaic and Hebrew and other Semitic languages being spoken, of course, in Jerusalem and in that area, and as well as around other parts of the world. So it probably was a surprise. Either way, this guy thought he was this Egyptian adventurer had come back for another round with the Jews. And it is not. So Paul is able to speak. And there in verse 39 and 40, we get a little bit of a resume or bio from Paul. He's going to give us a whole lot more here in a minute. Paul is, in fact, of course, a Roman citizen, so that's a good thing. This tribune picked this guy up when he did. He's from the city of Tarsus. He was Jewish, and he wanted to speak to the Jewish crowd. So with the help of the soldiers, he is able to address the people in Aramaic, because it was probably the language that most of them would understand. He is so able to get their attention through the waving of his hand, showing that he still has the power, even after being beat up, to get the control of crowds. And even when he started speaking Aramaic, which is, like I said, very well known to most of them, even probably a native language. And the Palestinian Jews probably would know that more than anything else. It was something that very much caught their attention, as we'll see as we go into chapter 22. Oh, the anticipation builds as we look at the first 21 verses. I kept that as a surprise because I know we're way well into this already. And another 21 verses, that just seems like a lot. It is, but there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of repetition here or retelling of stories that we've already kind of know the background, the history to, that we won't skip, but we will kind of do a light dusting of to provide a little bit more information here. So 22, 1 through 5. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet, and he said, oh, I know what he said. I just want to look at something. Yeah. Some of your translations will probably say Aramaic, like it says here. Anyways. I'm a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in the city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way. Remember, we've heard of this. I think it's the third time we've heard of this Christian belief to be referred to as the way to the death, blinding and putting both men and women into prisons, as also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify from them. I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. So we've heard this story again, and we're going to actually hear this story again in, I believe, chapter 26. We heard in chapter 9. We're hearing it again. He's going to run through the whole Damascus story again, Ananias and that all fun stuff. But I'm going to provide a little bit of context and a little bit more additional information through that. It seems like some of the stuff he's using here is very similar to what Stephen had said, related to kind of just kind of the background and the bio of who he is. He's, of course, speaking in their language that they would be very familiar with. So, of course, this would quiet them down. There in verses 3 and 4, we get a overview of his heritage and upbringing, of who he was in the past and how zealous he was, like many of them continue to be. There are plenty of people who are still very zealous for the Jewish faith, and he wants them to know that he understands that, because he used to be one of those people who were very zealous for the Jewish faith. It begins with giving an overview of his trip to Damascus to persecute the Messianic Jews there, and is instead commissioned by Jesus along the way to evangelize to the Gentiles of the world. We hear Paul's biography three times. Like I said, we heard this already in chapter 9, verses 1 through 22, and we'll hear it again in chapter 26, verses 2 through 23. And you'll notice that the versions change up a little depending on what his audience is. The main reason is that he's shaping it for his audience. A Jewish audience will hear this differently than a Roman audience will be whenever you're in chapter 26. So he'll say it a little bit differently as we go through this. And so it's not a contradiction. Some people who are skeptical of the Bible. We'll say, well, he's contradicting himself, or the writers are contradicting themselves, so thus it's not true. No, he's actually shaping the story so that the people who are listening would understand, much like we continue to do today when it comes to Scripture. You have to understand who your audience is, and that's what he's doing here. So though he was born in Tarsus, he grew up in Jerusalem, so he knew the cultures and traditions of the Jews in Jerusalem very well. He studied under one of the greatest Jewish leaders, teachers of that time, Gamaliel, and he was not, which he could have been. He could have been sent back to Tarsus, where he was born, for his education, but his parents made a very smart move and kept him there in Jerusalem, and he learned under Gamaliel. And recall, we know Gamaliel from earlier on, chapter 5, verse 34. He was a well-known and trusted leader of the Pharisees. He was also very educated and been known to say he was the Pharisee. A Pharisee is actually that's Paul who says that, but Gamaliel was very much a Pharisee of Pharisees as well. With that said, if you remember from chapter 5, Gamaliel was like, hey guys, let's put the brakes on this and see how this plays out. And let's not just start killing people. Paul, on the other hand, who was a student under Gamaliel, didn't always follow everything that Gamaliel taught, and started, of course, was the zealous guy. And so we have to remember that just because he learned under Gamaliel doesn't mean he followed all of Gamaliel's ways. He probably should have, but then the story wouldn't be at all as interesting as it is and is about to be. So the reason and excuse, you have to think that these people who are zealous for God, for the most part, give him the benefit of the doubt, much like Paul was. They're going after this new religion harder and faster than they have before because of their zeal for God. Though it's misunderstood, they have a zeal for God that they believe justifies what they're doing. And that's an easy argument to make for this, because that's exactly what they're doing, and it's the right way. It's the right way to be doing it. For them at that time. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier with James and Justin and the others. They are missing the point now. They haven't read the prophets. They've read them, but they haven't fully understood them. They're blind to what was being taught there about the messianic, the Messiah coming, the and everything related to what Jesus was to do here on earth, or the Messiah was to do here on earth. Verses 6 through 11. See, I told you this would be fast. But it happened that as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Remember, his name used to be Saul, the Jewish name. And I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus, the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. And those who you are with, me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, get up and go into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. I mean, he is literally approaching Damascus. I mean, he is outside the gates at this point. So it's not like he's walking 10 miles or 20 miles or 100 miles blind. He's there for the most part. So we get a full kind of quick overview of what happens to him as he's approaching the walls of Damascus, the blinding light at midday as they approach the walls. Notice how his name changed from Saul to Paul. Of course, it didn't change back at this point, but just to kind of tell the story, just as a reminder, the Saul being the Jewish name, and of course, Paul being the Greek name. And, you know, it probably changed depending on which group he was with, Jew or Gentile. This is, of the three tellings that I mentioned of 9, this one in 26, this is the only time where Jesus refers to himself as a Nazarene. Like in the other tellings, the companions saw the light, heard Saul speak, and were a bit stunned, but never heard Jesus speak. When Jesus speaks and tells Saul who he is, from this point forward, Saul has cemented his lifelong allegiance to Jesus and the work he is called to do for Jesus. So through ignorance and unbelief up to this point, he thought he was doing the work of God. But alas, he was not. He was fighting against God, kicking at goads, kicking goads, kicking the goads. It was not until Jesus got his attention to where Saul literally saw the light. And though the light blinded him at this point, at the same time, he saw what his role was to be as someone who was a follower of Christ. So, and to be a leader of Christ. Verses 12 through 16. A certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing near said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at the very time I looked up at him, and he said, The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and see the righteous one and hear an utterance from his mouth. He's using very, very Jewish words here again. When this was spoken from Ananias, who is a Jew, they're using, of course, righteous one is one of the key indicators of being a very Jewish word. For you'll be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. Let me just finish up here. 3:21. It happened when I returned to Jerusalem, I was praying in the temple, that I fell into a trance. And I saw him saying to me, Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believe in you. And when the blood of your witness, Stephen, was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him. And he said to me, Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And then it gets even worse for Paul after this point, Saul Paul, because he said the word Gentiles. Well, Jesus actually said it, but he's repeating it, quoting it. And that is where we will end. But let's do a quick explanation of those last few verses, but we'll start next time on verse 22. We're reintroduced to Ananias. We remember him from well back when, a well-respected leader in Syria. Of course, Damascus is in Syria. Much like Saul had been, Ananias is also a devout, law-abiding Jew. And Paul, at this point, Saul, is also a devout Jew. So it's two devout Jews speaking to each other. One just happens to have a little different perspective now, recently coming over him. And Ananias, through the power of Jesus, has had Paul look up as a way to say, receive the power of sight again, or as a way to say, this is your new life, and see it for what it is. And Paul repeats Ananias' saying from chapter 9, but it's a bit different. And it seems to allow Paul here for more detail of Paul's new call, or the call that was always set for his life, now communicated in a way that he could not ignore. What is fascinating and interesting about this whole thing here is that the words given by Jesus to Paul through Ananias, who is pious and believing Jew, this is a pious Jew speaking to someone who is now to go preach to the Gentiles. And pious Jews did not talk about positive things about the Gentiles. So this is just showing you the power of the situation of what is going on here, the work that God is doing. When you read chapter 26, you'll note that the testimony of the pious Jew is not stressed like it is here, mainly because they don't care in Rome. It's a different audience, and so it's completely different point of view and different sort of perspective. In 26, it is Jesus speaking, chapter 26, it is speaking that what it is Jesus speaking what Ananias is speaking here. Either way, Jesus gives a charge. So Ananias speaks here, and if you go to chapter 26 and read the same thing, Jesus is actually saying the words that you're reading that Ananias is saying. Doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it is Jesus who's giving the charge. Notice how Ananias says, God of our fathers, pointing back to the Jewish patriarch. In Gentile context, it would be more like, Lord, that is Jesus, so that they would understand it from that perspective. They would have a better understanding of that and don't really care who the Jewish patriarchs are. But the Gentiles would understand who Jesus is and cares who Jesus is. Not that they don't care, but it doesn't have as much meaning or significance to the Gentiles. So Paul now has his instructions and his way forward, but before proceeding, much like we see through all these other groups that he's met with, after believing, they must be baptized as an outward visual sign of his inward spiritual cleansing from sin. And from that point forward, the power of Jesus would be the dominant power in his life, and the rest and and for the rest of his life. Verses 17 through 21, what Paul's reflecting on here is from his visit back in chapter 9, verses 26 through 30, when visiting Jerusalem for the first time after his conversion. It seemed that his heart desire and prayer to God for Israel's salvation, and this isn't just forgiving of sins, but this is saving of lives, saving of souls. Something we know that he wrote to the Romans from Romans 10, verse 1. He wants to tell his fellow Jews to know the power of Jesus. His vision was probably influenced from the vision of Isaiah. So if you go back to Isaiah 6, chapter 6, 1 through 13, Isaiah is told to persist in his vision and stick around, even though things are going to go bad, while Paul, knowing that he's about to get beat up or killed, is told to leave, which is what he should be doing, even though he is a little bit obstinate about doing that. Isaiah is told to persist, even though things are going rough for him. Remember, during his time in Jerusalem, the first time he debated heavily with the Hellenists and aroused a significant amount of hostility as they remembered his zealous ways before his conversion. He is now, to them, a traitor and a turncoat, because he's been telling all these bad things about Jews and telling people to do bad things to Jews, or not Jews should no longer be Jews. Anyways, nothing good. But through the vision, he sees again that he is to go to the Gentiles. He is no longer to speak only to Jews, though if you remember, he goes to all the synagogues and all the cities that he goes into because he wants to start there. Maybe that's just his personality kind of push a little bit, but or he feels that's his call. Unfortunately, at this time, Jerusalem has closed its ears to Paul. Even back then, when he was first in Jerusalem at his first visit back in chapter 9, they had closed their ears to him, much like I've looked at it as Pharaoh hardening his heart. He, however, still wants to persist in Jerusalem. He still wants to save them or bring salvation, but they have a long and vivid memory of what he did to Stephen, and so they don't want him there. His hope, of course, is that this drastic change would make him more believable, that he has changed from being the zealous person of God to being someone who is a follower and a extremely strong follower and believer of the Messianic Christ. They didn't see this way. They saw him as a traitor. They were unwilling to listen at all. And then, much like in chapter 9, Paul will be removed or physically helped to be removed from Jerusalem. And that is where we're going to end today, because chapter 22, verse 22, which is always a fitting way to stop, is where we are. And that's where we'll stop today. And we'll run through chapter 23, probably, wow, Paul conspiracy. Probably, oh, look at that. We'll probably do 23, 22, based on how everything's kind of breaking out here. So next time, hope everyone has a great Christmas. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.